because we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Listen to the awful.
Talking about my generation.
I hope I die before I get old. Dig what we all say. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation.
I'm
just talking about my generation. What we all
talking about my generation.
I'm trying to cause a big sensation.
Just
talking about my generation. Cause we get around.
The irony is about that song is that Roger Daltrey, who was singing it and sang the line, "I hope I die before I get old," he just turned 71. 71 years old, bless his soul, and that is not old. So today we're going to be talking about generational shifts. Once upon a time, a long time ago, a king had this huge boulder placed in the middle of the road. Then he hid himself over to the side and watched to see if anyone was going to remove that huge rock. Now, some of the king's very wealthiest merchants and his courtiers and his highest nobles came by, and they just simply walked around it. Many loudly blamed the king for not keeping the roads clear and said, "What the heck are they doing with our tax dollars?" But none did anything at all about getting that stone out of the way. Then a peasant came along carrying a load of vegetables from market. Seeing the boulder, the peasant looked at it, then laid down his load of vegetables and tried to move the stone off the road. And after much pushing and straining and effort, he succeeded. And he got that boulder out of the road so everyone could pass freely. Then the peasant picked up his load of vegetables and was about to walk on when he suddenly noticed that there was this big bag lying in the road where the boulder had been. And the bag contained many gold coins and a note from the king saying that the gold was for the person who removed the boulder from the roadway. And the peasant with his vegetables learned what many of us never really quite understand. Every obstacle presents an opportunity to improve our condition. And today, I'm hoping that we can see these generational shifts, which many of us see as an obstacle, or even a big fat pain in the ass, but they can actually be an opportunity for us and an opportunity for our congregations. So yeah, we're dealing with generations. We're dealing with generations and a whole cluster of little elements that are tied to generational culture shifts, changing patterns of marriage and family, declining family religious socialization, individualism in the midst of diversity and religious identity formation, and then if we get to it and don't run out of time, aging baby boomers. My favorite thing right now. Okay. Generational shifts are impacting a number of areas that also impact our congregations. I'm going to show you a little video from the Pew Research Center, and it has Dr. Paul Taylor there, who has been looking at the full gamut of major generational shifts in the United States that we're facing today. This has been his specialization. And he talks about this cluster of issues and the impact on major cultural anchors, institutions like marriage, institutions like political parties, and we already know institutions like religion.
So millennials are a generation, we define them as having been born after 1980, so the oldest of them is in his or her early 30s, the youngest mid-teenagers, typically generations last about 20 years or so. We don't really know when the back half of this generation ends. There's probably a 12 or 13-year-old who's somebody different, but he or she hasn't quite come of age yet. It's a very distinctive generation, and the oldest of them has now made the passage into adulthood, so we know a little bit more about them than we did 8 or 10 years ago when they first came on the scene. Distinctive, they're a very large generation. By the time the 20-year cycle is done, they'll probably be 80 million strong, the largest generation since the baby boomers. They are very distinctive racially and ethnically. They are the transitional generation in an America that in the middle of the last century was about 85% white. By the middle of this century, will be only a little more than 40% white. Millennials are the most non-white generation. They're more than 4 in 10 are non-white. This is driven by the great modern immigration wave that's now about 4 or 5 decades old. Unlike our earlier immigration waves, which are almost entirely from Europe, this immigration wave is mostly from Latin America and Asia. And it's the immigrants themselves, but more so now it's the children of the immigrants, the U.S.-born children of the immigrants, who make up a very heavy portion of this millennial generation. They're distinctive politically. They're now old enough to have voted in 2 or 3 presidential elections, and they were a very big part of both of President Obama's victories. By our calculation, the Pew Research Center, where I work and did a lot of the research that led to this book, they are the most democratic voting generation of young adults of any that we have seen in 50 or 60 years of tracking voting patterns. They're very liberal in their social and cultural values, so some of the changes that are going on in the country on issues like same-sex marriage, marijuana legalization, actually pretty dramatic changes in a fairly short period of time in terms of public attitudes. It's the millennials, it's the young adults who are leading the way. Despite their distinctive political and social views and voting behaviors, however, they're not terribly attached to the Democratic Party, even though they gave big votes to Democratic presidential candidates. When we ask adults of all ages, are you a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent? Millennials, 50% of millennials say I'm independent. We've never seen that high a share from any age cohort.
We see a similar thing when we ask about their religion. What are you? Protestant, Catholic, Muslim, Hindu, Jewish? A record share of millennials say, I'm nothing in particular. And there's a third anchor institution of society, if you will, that millennials are not attached to, and that's a little old 5,000-year institution called marriage. So of today's 18 to 33-year-olds, only about a quarter are married. If you go back to older generations when they were the same age, 5 in 10, 6 in 10, the oldest generation, more than 6 in 10 were married. I think the slow walk toward marriage and the disassociation from anchor institutions, I think, are explained by, first, their economic circumstances. Another distinctive thing about this generation is they're the first in modern American history, and perhaps the first in American history, that at least so far, we don't know how their story ends, but we know how the story of their economic lives have begun, and at least so far, they're the first generation in modern times that is doing less well economically than their parents' generation on any way you measure it, whether it's income, whether it's wealth, whether it's poverty, whether it's employment, unemployment, all the classic measures, and you correct for inflation and you make it an apples-to-apples comparison, they're doing less well. The fact that they're doing less well means a lot of them, when we ask them, those who aren't married, would you like to marry? Almost, 7 in 10 say yes. Why haven't you gotten married? Well, look at me. I don't have a job. I don't have a career. I don't have the economic foundation to get married. And that will reverberate in interesting ways as they mature into middle age and beyond. And then finally, perhaps if not the most distinctive thing about this generation, certainly one of the most distinctive things is they are a first generation of digital natives. So they are the only age group of adults now for whom these amazing gadgets we now all hold in our hand and we all take for granted that within three clicks you can access the sum of all human knowledge. And frankly, these days, if it takes you a third click, you're wondering what takes so long. So to somebody my age, this is jaw-dropping. It's still jaw-dropping every time I access these information platforms and do it in mobile sites, and I'm just amazed. These young adults are not amazed. It's the only world they've ever known, and they are carnivores in terms of their habits with these information systems, not just for information acquisition, but for the creation of networks. They organize their social lives around these networks. They can build their own tribes. Somebody more clever than me described them as a pre-Copernican generation. The universe really does revolve around them because they can build their social networks and they can place themselves at the center of their social networks because their social networks are built around the things they care the most about, whether it's their hobbies, whether it's their work, whether it's the games they like to play, whether it's information seeking and all the rest. This behavior has led some to suggest that it's a narcissistic generation. My own view is that that's a bum rap. I think it's all about the new platforms and it's all about the human condition. And if you have the ability to kind of place yourself at the center of the universe, you will take it. I think it's empowering. It may lead to a trait of the millennials. They're somewhat distrustful of other people. And it may be because as they navigate the online world, it turns out not everybody is exactly who they say they are. And there's a certain wariness about this generation. And I think there's an interesting question about whether the networks that they build online with the median millennial has 250 quote-unquote friends on Facebook. Somebody my age or older has only one-fifth that amount of friends, and many fewer of us are on Facebook. So, discuss among yourselves, has there been a quantum leap in human friendliness over the past few generations, or is it simply that the new platforms create new behaviors and new ways of organizing your social life? It's clearly the latter. I think an interesting question, I don't think we know the answer to it yet, is as millennials age more into middle age, as they probably age into some of the more traditional anchor institutions of society, marriage, children, home ownership, and all the rest, and these things are all happening more slowly for millennials, will they establish a more of an offline network that begins to resemble the networks and the affiliations and associations that their parents and grandparents built?
All right. Well, that gives you an entire generation in a nutshell, in a five-minute nutshell. How did some of these changes come about? What are some of the other impacts, the other elements that are going into this? Now, Putnam and Campbell, in their little book, American Grace, they looked at the effect that major recent social shocks have had on our society. The first shock was the 60s revolution, hence our little video to start off this morning. And those of us that lived through that, remember that this was a major shock to our social system. Aftershock number one, following that, I think we can understand as a reaction or an overreaction to the shock of the 60s. And that major aftershock in the 1970s and 80s was the rise of evangelicals, conservative churches, and the religious right. Putnam and Campbell say this was a reaction to the 60s. Then Putnam and Campbell find that the second aftershock, the rise of a more secular generation, is happening right now and is the result of a larger, younger generation growing increasingly liberal on certain moral and lifestyle issues, as contrasted with an older generation of religious leaders who they think seem consumed by political fights around homosexuality and marriage equality and things like that. Now, Putnam and Campbell did a lot of research in this wonderful book, and they note that if just the youngest cohort in a society changes some of its attitudes and then persists in that change throughout their entire life cycle, society as a whole will change. But that change can be slow, or that change can be mighty darn fast. If the differences between one generation and the next are small, then generationally based social change will be real, but very slow, kind of almost imperceptible at times, like a massive supertanker, you know, trying to change direction. But if a younger generation differs substantially in major ways from its predecessors in some central social attitudes, then the social change can be extremely quick and very significant over just a few decades. Just a few decades. And I think we see this latter at work right now in the sudden shift of social attitudes towards LGBTQ people. I mean, who would have thought that 10 years ago that we would be celebrating marriage equality at SI tonight? Right? I mean, and remember, millennials are the largest generation alive in the United States. So boomers, I'm sorry, you thought you had impact. These guys are going to have huge impact. And they're already 35 years old. They're already 35 years old. Now, one interesting little fact that we might want to keep in mind. Pew reports that Roman Catholics, whom we UUs tend to think of as rather socially conservative, are actually more supportive of legal recognitions of same-sex relationships than Americans overall. Seriously. Catholics support rights for gays and lesbians higher than among the general public. And 75% of Catholics think that same-sex relationships should be accepted and celebrated by society. So it turns out that we liberal folk are likely to overestimate the opposition to equality among some faith traditions by as much as, you know, 20%. So in other words, don't judge a book by its cover or a person by their religious affiliation. Okay. Now, we know that a third of young adults are nuns, only 25% or less attend worship weekly. The sociologist Christian Smith recently observed that liberal Protestantism's organizational decline has been accompanied by and is in part of the consequence of the fact that liberal religion has won a decisive, larger cultural victory. Liberals have won the larger cultural victory, the larger cultural war, he says. And he says this cultural victory did not happen because more Americans joined liberal churches, but because liberal religious values have become more and more culturally normative. And he says that these trends are clearly more pronounced, of course, among the millennial young adults. Now, as Putnam and Campbell noted, it takes time for generational shifts to occur, but sometimes that time is very, very short. Now, this little chart, just to give you some info here, is showing some of the attitude shifts towards institutions. This group, this chart was put together by the Barna Group, another research group. The first line of each segment on this chart, the light kind of blue-gray line, which, yeah, the top line of each one, shows millennial attitudes of trust in comparison to trust by other generations in certain institutions. And as we look at this, we see that there's universities, churches, for-profit companies, corporations, President of the United States, congressional representatives, government, and in all of these, except the church, millennials trust all of these institutions more than other generations. But on the church, millennials trust the church less than any other generation. Kind of an interesting juxtaposition there. So what are the millennial concerns? I mean, if we want to engage this huge cohort of people who are right now 35 years old, okay, and in their mid-30s and younger, we have to know what they want or looking for in a spiritual life. Now, according again to research by Faith Formation 2020 that did a lot of this work, they say that millennials want expressive, experiential faith activities in their learning, in their worship, in their rituals, in their prayer. And they want physical community with others. Even though they're digital natives, they want physical community. They want a faith that makes cognitive sense to them and is also expressive and embodied in that spiritual experience. Personal connection is highly valued. Millennials want a personal, direct connection. In terms of service in society, they want to make a difference in the world. It's not enough to talk a good game. They want to see results. They want to experience their faith in concrete ways and know that it makes that difference in the world. And millennials want a sense of graciousness in their spiritual lives. They are tired of faith communities that are divisive and critical or judgmental or harsh around anything. Richard Flory and Donald Miller, in their book Finding Faith, found that millennials, quote, want a faith that makes cognitive sense and that is expressive, embodied spiritual experience. Young adults are searching for a more holistic faith than anything that is simply purely cognitive or a rational approach. They are seeking a deep spiritual experience and a community experience, each of which provides them with meaning in their lives and each of which is meaningless without the other. So the cognitive, the rational approach isn't gonna touch it. The experiential spiritual, the experiential community is what they're looking for. And actually, I got some stuff on Friday that really highlights this. And it's very important to know, of course, the reasons behind why millennials are disaffected from organized religion right now. But the big question for us is, what can we as Unitarian Universalists offer them? What do we offer them? How can we meet them where they are? Okay. Oh, well, let me stop this one. This is not working right. Okay, hold on just a second. Come on, you. There we are. I'm going to show you a little video about millennials and their values, and it's focusing on a values conference that was made up of young adults very recently. And let's see if we've got sound on this.
These millennial values fellows came to Georgetown University from around the United States to talk about faith and other issues facing their generation.
Hi, I'm Abigail Claus. I'm also one of the fellows.
And Abigail Claus is a religion major at Boston University.
Millennials kind of have a complicated relationship with religion. I know that's true in my own personal life.
Claus was raised in South Carolina by a Southern Baptist father and a Roman Catholic mother.
And I actually identify as Unitarian Universalist now.
A survey carried out by the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University found that many millennials leave the faith they were raised in, mostly ending up unaffiliated. Around one quarter don't identify with any religion. It's something Claus has seen on campus.
There's a lot of shifting, and people don't tend to be as kind of committed to like one set of strict set of doctrines or dogmas, you know, even if they might be like spiritual still.
And only 23% of the survey's respondents say they believe the Bible is the Word of God and should be taken literally. College campuses are among the least religious places in America because many people drift away from faith when they're young. But millennials appear to be doing it in ways that are different from previous generations.
But as you can see, basically all of the varieties of Christian religion are actually in negative territory.
Robert Jones heads the Public Religion Research Institute, which participated in the survey.
One of the things we found in this report is that the youngest millennials in the country, that is 18 to 24-year-olds, really do look to change the face of religion in the country.
The face of religion in America has long looked like this. But the Georgetown study suggests millennials are rejecting bricks and mortar religion in favor of spirituality with less commitment, says Jones.
They're less looking for the traditional structured church experience.
And many are not necessarily finding it online. Researchers found that fewer than half of millennials with Facebook accounts list religious affiliation on their profile page. Jerome Sokolowski, VOA News, Washington.
Okay. Now, let me try to summarize this next little article. It's the top 10 list. 10 reasons why churches may not be having millennials in their pews. And it's from Reverend Frank Powell, who serves in the Campbell Street Church of Christ in Tennessee, in Jackson, Tennessee. And he works exclusively with college age and young adults. And this recent article was like 10 pages long, so let me see if I can summarize it for you in a lot less time. Now, he claims that all congregations of all faith traditions have really failed in a large measure to take stock of this generation because they are different. And this lack of knowledge breeds fear, which he says is true of many congregations in relation to millennials. They don't know what to do with them. Many churches don't take the time to know the next generation, so they're stuck with, you know, some stereotypes. They're attaching stigmas. They're attaching prejudged ideas to the whole group of millennials. At the same time, there are some congregations that have thriving millennial cultures and groups. So what differentiates a church that welcomes millennials from one that repels them? That's the nature of his article. He says there are a lot of important factors, but he outlines what he calls the top 10. So if your congregation wonders why there might not be a whole lot of millennials in the pews, you know, you might take a look at these top 10 and think about it. He says, one, if there's a strong resistance to change, millennials won't be there. The next generation doesn't understand why churches refused to change a program or an activity or even an entire culture if it isn't effective anymore. If it doesn't work, change it. Millennials don't hold tradition close to their hearts. In fact, many traditions are often the enemy because churches allow traditions to hinder them in moving forward. So young adults are tired of hearing the phrase, "This is how we've always done it," because that answer is no longer seen to be acceptable. And remember, millennials want to change the world. The second one, a compelling vision is lacking or non-existent in the church. Millennials will not invest in a church that refuses to dream big in its vision. Now, you might think that they are naive, you know, but most millennials don't believe that they have to wait until they receive a certain degree or reach a certain age to start nonprofits or even plant new churches or lead businesses or whatever. They expect that same kind of experimental, entrepreneurial, willing to experiment and fail spirit in their churches. Third, mediocrity. Quite simply, the next generation is not content with mediocrity. They believe they can and that they will change the world. Good or bad, they have a strong desire for the extraordinary. And they aren't afraid to fail, though, in their attempt to reach that extraordinary. And they believe that our congregations, our faith communities, need to have a similar mindset. And fourth, a paternalistic approach to leading young adults. Powell says that if you want to push the next generation out your doors, don't let them lead. Simply giving them a title means nothing. Titles are irrelevant. They want to be trusted to fulfill the task that's given to them. If you micromanage them, if you treat them like children, or refuse to believe that they're capable of being leaders in your congregation because of their age or lack of experience or wisdom or whatever, they will be out the door very quickly, he says. If you refuse to let them lead, they will quickly find another church or another community or another context where they can use their talents and gifts to their full potential. Fifth one, there's a pervasive insider-focused mentality. Some people kind of call this narcissism of American religion. The questions that we've wrestled with for so many years, you know, do you have a traditional or contemporary worship? Do you have the band in there or the organ? Do you have a board of directors or a staff-led church? Or, you know, just all that kind of stuff. They think that these kinds of discussions are sideways energy and pretty darn irrelevant. Millennials won't attend churches that are dealing with questions that they think nobody is really asking. So what's important to millennials? What's important in the questions they ask is, how does a church respond to the needs of the world, locally and globally? How does a church respond to the poor and the homeless and the needy and the widowed and the orphans in their community? If you want to ensure that your church has very few millennials, answer the questions that nobody is asking. Spend most of your resources, Powell says, on building programs and programs that have little or nothing to do to impact outside the church walls. Spend massive amounts of money on inefficient and ineffective programs that don't change the world, and that he can guarantee that you won't have young adults. He says, six, transparency, authenticity. If they're not high values, there won't be young adults. Most millennials value these highly, and if your church portrays some kind of holier-than-thou or elitist attitude, then it's going to be largely devoid of the next generation. Millennials do not think that they are perfect people, and they're not looking for perfect people, but they are looking for people to be real and honest about struggles and temptations and the trials of life. Seven, mentoring. While millennials don't want to be paternalistically micromanaged, they do place a high value on learning with other generations. They value the wisdom and insight from other generations. It's a valuable treasure to them. And they'll travel long distances to get to it. So if your church is generationally divided, with very little contact between the children and the youth and the young adults and the elders, then you can be sure that you really may not have those young adults there much longer. That's what Powell says. He also says that if you view culture as the enemy, then you can forget about it. Millennials are tired of the church being viewed, tired of the church viewing the culture as some kind of enemy or force to be combated. Instead, millennials embrace and engage the culture in many, many ways. Now, I know the church doesn't stand at the cultural center of community or society anymore, but the church did help shape the culture in the past, and that's no longer true. So they have welcomed and adapt what they find outside of themselves. Ninth one, community is not valued. If community is not valued in your church, that's really a non-negotiable with millennials. This is a great part of their lives. And they aren't looking for another group of people to watch the Browns or the Steelers with on Sunday. The next generation desires a spiritual and deep community connection. They value community that moves beyond the surface and starts asking hard questions that are deep. Community isn't an optional part of a millennial's life. It's essential. And then 10th, on this list, the church as a source of division rather than unity. Powell notes that nothing frustrates millennials more than a church that doesn't value unity. They are frustrated by snarky church fights. They want an environment where everyone feels welcomed and accepted. Churches that value racial and generational and socioeconomic inclusivity will attract more millennials. Now, Powell says that some churches don't see the value of changing to welcome this generation, but once folk realize that, you know, this idea is wrong, it might be a little too late. The millennials are a huge part of the population today. And if your church isn't serious about having people there and working with them in the future, then your church also needs to be serious about understanding what this generation's looking for. That's his main point. Okay. Top 10 list. Next driving factor that we're looking at with all of this is changing patterns of family life in the United States. They're delaying marriage, having fewer children later in life, decreasing numbers of children in two-parent households, increasing numbers of unmarried couples living together, and increasing time spent caring for children. The impact on congregations among these elements is very real. Now, in past generations, we knew that or expected young people to leave high school, you know, and leave the church at the same time, and they go to college, and then they come back when they get married in their 20s, they settle down, they have kids, they come for religious education. I mean, this has been a pattern, you know, for a number of decades and decades and decades. And it's a predictable pattern that many congregations counted on. I hear it all the time. I hear it all the time. Oh, we're going to keep all of this going, and we're going to know that the RE is going to grow again really soon because millennials are getting older. But it's no longer the pattern we find in young families today. Instead, as we've noted, young adults are getting married at much later ages or not marrying at all. This little chart shows the decline in marriage age among the young. We see that back in 2013, 26% of millennials were married at the very same age that they are now. In the silent generation, 65% were married. That shows you the huge difference in terms of that particular institution. The median age at first marriage now is among the highest in modern history. 29, the age of 29 for men, 27 for women. A Pew report in 2014 noted that that millennials were less likely to be married than the group that preceded them, of course, between the ages of 18 and 32. We also know that that they are having fewer children, and they're having children later in life. The average age for having the first child now is 34. So this is a big shift. I mean, my mother had me when she was 19. This is a huge shift in our society, and she wasn't unusual. Lots of young mothers around there for her to socialize with. And we all know that young families have increasing busy lives. They're going to this camp and soccer and these lessons and all of this stuff. And sometimes Sunday morning is the only time they have for family time. And what do we do, pardon me, but we tend to separate the children over there and the adults over there when they're craving family time together. We got to think about that. We got to think about that. Now, all these changes began in the early 1990s, and we're now beginning to see the fruit of these. Some of our faith cousins, the Roman Catholics, the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, that have a big life cycle kind of focus for their religious education, they're seeing fewer marriages, people marrying later, having fewer children, so there are fewer baptisms and fewer first communions and fewer confirmations. And so then, of course, they see fewer members. Now, for those of us like Unitarian Universalists who focus more on the religious education on Sunday morning, there's something very similar there. The result is that there are fewer young families with fewer children, and these families are staying home or doing family things on Sunday morning. So that means there are fewer children in religious education classes, not in any particular church, but this is talking about demographics overall. And of course, if the kids aren't in RE, then the parents are not attending, because or they're not joining the church for the children's sake. And these declines, all of this stuff raises the anxiety in all faith traditions, in all congregations. We know that. Okay, one other driving force, declining family religious socialization. Because sociologists say that children and teens with active practicing religious parents are more likely than those without such parents to think and feel and believe and act as serious religious believers in their later years. I mean, you see it modeled. And that training does tend to stick with some of the kids, even when they leave home and enter young adulthood. But we stopped doing that kind of socialization at home sort of a long time ago. It's called embedded family religious practices, and Pew did a study on this, and they found that effective religious habits in the home have been on the decline since the baby boomers. You know, like family life, like family study of religious texts. They noted prayer. They noted telling religious stories, building religious identity in the home. These have just not been happening in recent decades. It started declining back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, when the boomers were already rejecting a lot of this. Even those who still attend church on Sunday morning are doing very little in terms of the home religious socialization and identity formation. Now, I'll say that it might help if, you know, we reinvigorated embedded spiritual practices in the family. It might help in terms of future generations and their commitment to a religious identity. But most researchers say that's not going to change the reality of moving into the moving into the situation of being unaffiliated or spiritual but not religious. Let's see. Okay, another quick driving force here is religious identity and individualism. We're looking at the increasing impact that this has on the way people form their identity as a religious person or as a spiritual person. Religious identity nowadays is more autonomous, individual, deliberate, intentionally chosen. It's not necessarily tied to any perceived need for communal or institutional structures. We see that. Faith Formation 2020 researchers found that among young adults, individual personal experience trumps doctrine or belief when it comes to spirituality. Young adult life experience and encounters with religion are increasingly diverse in this age of religious diversity. And young adults place a very high value on freedom of individual thought and choice. They will choose, and they will churn, and they will move, and they will choose different things at different times, at different years. The faith formation researchers say that young adults increasingly find themselves to be spiritual tinkerers. This is the term that they're using, spiritual tinkerers. They're improvisational. They're inventive. They're adept at bringing together a number of different disparate religious teachings and cultural components and use them to form their own personal religious identity. And I think we can all think of some young folk that we know who have done that. Now, just to let you know, though, religious tinkering is not new in the United States. Dr. Matthew Hedstrom and University of Virginia says that much of the major religious dynamism in American history has occurred outside of church walls and has involved elements from a diversity of religious traditions. Think of our own transcendentalism back in the early 1800s and how reliant that was on the tinkering they did by bringing in Buddhism. And they were the first to translate Buddhist texts into English. Today, tinkerers can be seen as the latest phase in this long dynamic of non-institutional spiritual tradition that, like I said, stems from the 1800s and on beyond. Our current understanding of spirituality as an individual, experiential human encounter with the sacred came out of this clash of American Protestantism with the forces of modern life during the last 150 years. That's when it really started to take off. Now, religious conservatives fought to block the tide of modernism in the 19th and 20th centuries that gave rise to fundamentalist thought and the right wing. And religious liberals adapted their faith to modernity, discarding orthodoxies and creeds in favor of Darwinism and psychology and comparative religions, and we know that. So Hedstrom finds that the majority of today's young adult tinkerers are engaged in the task of restructuring and renovating faith for a new social historical context, just like their liberal predecessors did. Okay. Today's millennials and spiritual but not religious folk typically shun dogma and creed in favor of a faith that is practical, psychologically attuned, ecumenical, cosmopolitan in diversity, and strongly ethically oriented. They embrace a dynamic of basic beliefs that focus on inner sources of spirituality and a this world rather than a next world or afterlife focus, a fundamental unity between science and religion, an equality between genders and races, and they are more willing to test beliefs and change them when they prove to be totally untenable. And this sounds really familiar to us. And then before I show the next little video clip, I want to just, oh dear, no, nope. We are out of time. So I will show the next video this afternoon. It is a wonderful summation of all of this called Why Millennials Are Rejecting the Church, Marriage, and Republicanism. And it goes a lot more into the political realities there. So if you want to see that one, and it is a good one, come on this afternoon. And we'll also talk about our friends, the aging baby boomers, and what that is doing to our congregations. So, thank you very much. I know there was a lot of talking today, but there was a lot of stuff there to get through. Take care.